Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the Bay Area Performing Arts. Today we raise the virtual curtain of our Corona Radio Theater for members of the theater company Word for Word once again, and they're reading this week of Favors by Alice Adams, an intergenerational story of resentment, kindness, and compassion. I'll talk to piano Marilla artists Tamara Sanakidze and Ronnie Michael Greenberg about upcoming virtual recitals by the Marilla Opera Program. And Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large, Peter Robinson, reflects on this turbulent and historic month, offers some outdoor activities, and reflects on the season. Stay with us. Well, as performing arts organizations across the country continue to wrestle with the impact of COVID-19 on live presentations, not to mention their revenue stream, many continue to offer enthusiastic experiences online to keep their audiences engaged. The Marilla Opera Program, training the singers, coaches, and opera professionals of tomorrow, is no exception. I'm pleased to welcome two Marilla pianists to talk about a couple of upcoming virtual Marilla events. Pianist educator Dr. Tamara Sanakidze was born into a musical family in Tbilisi, Georgia, and has performed on the most prestigious stages throughout Europe, Asia, and the Americas. She currently serves as the director of the Butler Opera Center, as well as head of voice division at the Butler School of Music at the University of Texas, Austin. She's also on the faculty of the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara, and since 2010 has been a regular member of the music staff at both the San Francisco Opera and Los Angeles Opera, working as a musical coach, rehearsal pianist, prompter, and assistant conductor, in addition to working with many other prominent opera companies around the world. Welcome, Tamara.
Hello, good afternoon.
And pianist, opera coach, and producer Ronnie Michael Greenberg is a leading innovator in the world of performing arts. He's a native of Montreal and has toured internationally, performing in the world's premier opera houses and concert halls. Not only involved in the musical arts, he's combining the musical, visual, and culinary arts as CEO and artistic director of Taste of Talent, a performing arts organization that showcases the connective power of music and art through sensational experiences and promotes the entrepreneurial empowerment of emerging artists. He's a full-time member of the San Francisco Opera's music staff and has also collaborated with San Francisco Ballet, Opera San Jose, Opera Parallel, Townsend Opera, and Yale Opera, among others. Welcome to you, Ronnie.
Hello, it's great to see you.
Well, I think in this time of COVID, pianists maybe have it a little easier than other performing artists in that you have a certain solitary bent and ability to be a one-man band, so to speak, used to these solitary hours of practice and performance. Tamara, let's start with you. I imagine you'd more be willing and wanting to work with opera artists at the moment, but the piano must provide some solace for you.
Definitely, there is a silver lining there, because in these solitary days, months, unfortunately, I had chance to go back to my solo piano background and explore and discover things and discover things that I didn't have time before. So I have been enjoying being alone, although I have 8-year-old daughter who is going online schooling, so I don't have too much time alone. But when I do, it's really nice to sit at the piano and play solo music.
Well, special kudos to those that are not only engaged in the performing arts, but trying to raise kids and educate them instead of saying, okay, see you at 4, see you at 5. It's a brave new world there. Good for you.
Yes.
Ronnie, same question. I imagine the piano is providing some solace, but you'd rather be collaborating a little bit more.
definitely it's been a big thing during this whole pandemic to have a piano in my apartment. I'm very grateful. I used to love having the piano to practice at home, but I only during this year realized how grateful I was to have this, you know, acoustic instrument in my apartment. And thankfully, all of my neighbors enjoy the music as well.
That's terrific. Well, of course, you're involved with Marilla as not only Marilini alumni, not to be a solo performer, but to be a collaborative artist. Difficult to do right now, at least in person, with artists who, let's face it, spew their very musicality in a way that is not socially acceptable right now. So how have your responsibilities changed with Marilla since this past March? Let's start with you, Tamara.
Well, unfortunately, with everything negative that came with this COVID world, it also, again, silver lining here, showed us new opportunities to connect, new experiences to experience. And Zoom, of course, has come like a night saving the world, as certainly world of academia and education. I've been quite busy, actually, working with the artists in Marilla and Adler Fellows, as well as my own students at Butler School of Music. And in a way, Zoom shrunk the world because I regularly coach with the singers who are not even on this continent. They're in Asia. I actually had two coachings this morning, one in China and one in Korea. So Zoom definitely is giving us an opportunity to expand our collaboration, although, of course, online, but we were able to connect with singers and upcoming young artists who will be maybe the names to know of in 5-10 years. So I have not slowed down a bit. In fact, I think I'm even busier.
That's what I'm hearing from a lot of folks that are embracing, or at least having to deal with and needing to embrace this new technology in terms of coaching, especially. Ronnie, I imagine you have the same kind of experience, not exactly ideal by Zoom, but offering, you know, you're missing some of the subtleties involved in coaching someone in a live situation, but also having, as Tamara mentioned, some new opportunities.
Yeah, it's been, of course, a huge challenge and learning curve to learn to use this technology, to learn video editing and sound recording. I've always enjoyed a challenge. It's been hard, but I'm really grateful for it. One of the things that I can do now is, you know, do recordings, maybe not at the highest standard of a recording studio, but I'm very happy to have learned these skills, even though I had never planned to. They're very useful for all of us moving forward. And it is great to be able to connect with artists from all around the world in this way, despite it not being in person, for sure.
Tamara, you're a part of the Marilla class of 2009. Take us back to that experience. Brian Jade, among the many wonderful alumni from that class.
Yes, we had amazing class and we had amazing Adler Fellows class as well. So in my day, in Marilla, we had Brian Jade, Sarah Gartland, Susanna Biller-Kness, who they're certainly having a very illustrious and busy careers. David Lomeli was my Adler Fellow, as well as Leah Crocetto. Of course, the San Francisco audience is very familiar with these names. Nadine Sierra joined us only 1 year later. So I think, and I may be biased, but I think we had the best class of all times.
Well, I think there's a level of bias there, but you have every right to brag, that's for sure.
Yes.
You're going to be involved in an afternoon of piano treasures with yourself and Eduardo Barsotti, a member of the class of 2014 and 15 Marilla Opera Program. How did this program evolve? This is going to be on Sunday, November 22nd at 4 p.m.
That's right. Couple of years ago, I played another Marilla signature event in San Francisco that time, and I always enjoy sharing my pianism with such lovely friends of Merola, Amici di Merola, as they call themselves, a wonderful group of people who appreciate arts and music so much. So this year when they contacted me, of course, I was only delighted to accept. By the way, I'm donating my honorarium back to arts, back to Merola, in memory of Janie Heggy, who was a tremendously involved a person in the Merola, and her husband Jim Heggy is still very much involved in Merola and Adler's lives. So I started thinking what would be appropriate pieces to play, and because of this somber atmosphere we're all experiencing now, this sense of loss, nostalgia, despair, but same time pensive, I decided the best would be to play Brahms' Three Intermezzo, Opus 117. He wrote that very late in his life, in 1892, I believe. He just died a few years later. And these pieces are, all three pieces are not necessarily characteristic to Brahms. They're very pensive, thoughtful, elegiac. So I wanted to devote these pieces and my performance to victims of COVID-19, as well as let us all heal during those 14 minutes. And we recently lost someone very, very special to us, Suzanne Turley, who was, I don't know, the greatest cheerleader to any Merolini and Adler fellow could ever have. So for her memory, I'm going to play Chopin C-sharp minor nocturne to dedicate to her memory.
Very nice. Also on the program, paraphrase on Verdi's Rigoletto by Liszt, which should be quite an experience. The Magic Waltz from The Legend of 1900 by Ennio Morricone, and Ravel's Jeu d'Eau, which we'll hear shortly. That sounds like a wonderful program. Again, on the 22nd of November at 4 p.m. Learn more at merola.org. Ronnie Greenberg, a Merolini, also like Eduardo from both 2014 and 2015. You're involved with the program a little later on called A Very Merola Holiday Recital. How did that evolve, and how were the singers chosen that you're collaborating with for that program on December 12th?
Well, we were thinking of what to call it, and we thought, why don't we just insert Merola in there? It's just a cute name. It's going to be a very eclectic program, and so we wanted equally eclectic voices. So we will have traditional holiday music, Christmas songs, but we'll also have some more like Handel type holiday music. And we're also going to have, I'm going to play La Campanella by Liszt, which is something that I think I just decided to add because it has the bells theme in it at the end of the program, and we're going to tie it in with Carol of the Bells. So it's going to be a very eclectic program. Alice Chung, who's the mezzo, will sing Mon Coeur s'ouvre à ta voix, which is just a lush, beautiful...
Oh, I love that aria. Absolutely.
There'll be Puccini, and I think we just kind of wanted to give a little bit of everything to everyone so that there's that variety.
Right. Soprano Maria Valdez from the class of 2013, Alice Chung from classes of 2017 and 19, Casey Candelbot, tenor, as well as Christian Purcell, bass baritone, and yourself accompanying. Let's give a shout out to the technical people that are involved in making these programs possible as well. You can learn about them and watch these programs, learn about how you can do that at Merola, merola.org. We'll have a link at our website, klw.org, under today's open air link. Ronnie, Tamara, thank you so much for joining us. We wish you well on the these two programs. And again, learn more at merola.org. Happy holidays to you. However you make them, may they be grand, safe, and happy.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Here's a little bit of Ravel's Jeu d'Eau, which you'll hear on the 22nd of November as part of a two pianist recital, an afternoon of piano treasures with Tamara Sanakidze and Eduardo Barsotti. Well, following a sold-out presentation of Lucia de Lammermoor in October, speaking of opera, San Francisco Opera returns to Fort Mason Flicks Drive-In with screenings of two popular operas by Puccini, La Boheme on the 20th of November and the 22nd, and Tosca at 5 and 8:30 p.m. on Friday, December 11th and on December 12th. Boheme features Piotr Beccalla as Rodolfo and Angela Giorgio as Mimi, with Nicola Luisotti at the baton. Tosca stars Adrian Pizonka as Rodolfo and Carlo Ventre as Cavaradossi, with Lado Atanelli as Scarpia under the baton of Bruno Campanella. Each opera will be projected on a 40-by-20 LED screen at the picturesque Marina Drive-In with views across the bay. On-site concessions and off-the-grid food trucks will be there. Find out more about these drive-in operas at sfopera.com. And if you're looking for a costume for next Halloween, or perhaps for some special dress-up occasion, the San Francisco Opera Costume Shop sale starts tomorrow at noon and runs through noon on Sunday. Learn about these costumes that you can get in all sorts of sizes, incredibly, impeccably made by the tailors and the seamstresses and seamstressers, I guess, at SF Opera. Learn about that at sfopera.com. Let's move on to our Corona Radio Theater segment for this week. And it's from American author Alice Adams, who was born in 1926 in Virginia, grew up in North Carolina, but spent most of her adult life in San Francisco until her passing in 1999. She was educated at Harvard and was a prolific, celebrated short story writer and novelist who wrote deftly about smart and independent women. We're pleased to present her 1986 work, Favors, for this week's Corona Radio Theater segment, an intergenerational story of resentment, kindness, and compassion. It will be performed by word-for-word actors James Wagner, Josiah Polhemus, Rosie Hallett, and Patricia Silver. The director is Amy Kossow. We thank Alice's son, Peter Linenthal, for his permission to perform the story.
We recognize that we come to you from unceded lands of indigenous peoples, and we thank
the Chochonyo,
Keech,
the Ramaytush Ohlone,
and we bring you Favors. July that year is hotter, the air heavier and more sultry than is usual in Northern California.
Especially up in the Sierras near Lake Tahoe. Along the Truckee River, which emanates from that lake, mosquitoes flourish in the thick green riverside bushes and grass.
Even in the early mornings, most unusual, it is already warm and damp.
An absolute stillness.
A brooding quiet.
If this were Maine, there would be a thunderstorm, remarks Maria. Maria Tresca, an elderly political activist just released from jail. By profession, she is an architect. A large-boned, heavy woman with gray-brown hair and huge dark eyes, she is addressing the much younger couple who are with her on the terrace of her river house.
The three of them
have just finished a light breakfast in the dining room, inside.
They now sit on old canvas deck chairs.
Having spoken, Maria closes her eyes as though the effort involved in keeping them open were more than she could manage in the breezeless heat, the flat air.
The two young people,
the couple, are Danny Michaels, a small, gray-blonde young man, rather lined for someone his age, serious, bookish looking.
And thin, bright red-haired Phoebe Knowles, Danny's very recent wife.
Oh, that would be wonderful, a storm, says Phoebe, who seems a little short of breath.
And Danny, we sure could use the rain.
Actually, I'd be quite terrified, Maria opens her eyes to tell them. I always used to be in Maine. We had the most terrific summer storms. She recloses her eyes.
Danny has known Maria for so long.
Almost all the 30-odd years of his life.
That nearly all questions seem permitted.
Also, they like and trust each other.
However, so far his evident sympathetic interest in her recent experience has been balked. About Pleasanton, where the jail was.
Maria has only said,
not quite convincingly,
it wasn't too bad. It's minimum security, you know. I felt rather like a Watergate conspirator. The clothes they gave me were terribly uncomfortable, though. Just not fitting. And stiff.
Only Maria's posture suggests discouragement, or even age.
On the old rattan sofa, she slumps down in a tired way among the cushions, her large hands clasped together on the knees of old corduroys, and goes on about Maine. The chipmunks there were much bigger than the ones out here, she tells Phoebe and Dan. Or maybe they only seemed bigger because I was very small. I haven't been back there since I was a child, you know.
Phoebe and Dan are in the odd position of being both Maria's hosts and her guests.
It is her house.
In fact, very much her house, designed by Maria for her own use.
But it was lent to Danny and Phoebe by Ralph Tresca, Maria's son and a great friend of Danny's. This was to be their wedding present. 2 weeks alone in this extraordinary, very private house.
For which they had both arranged.
With some trouble.
To take off from their jobs.
Phoebe and her best friend Anna run a small restaurant on Potrero Hill.
Danny works in a bookstore also on Potrero, of which he is part owner.
Danny and Ralph have been friends since kindergarten?
And thus Danny has known Maria for all that time. He and Phoebe have known each other for...
less than 4 months.
Theirs was a passionate...
somewhat hasty...
marriage.
Indeed. Precipitated by Ralph's offer of the house.
Danny called Ralph.
In Los Angeles, where Ralph is a sometime screenwriter.
To say that... he had met a girl about whom he was really serious. I think we might get married.
To which Ralph responded, well, if you do it this summer, you can have the house for 2 weeks at the end of July. It's rented for most of the rest.
Not the reason.
Surely.
But an impetus. Danny has always loved the beautiful, not entirely practical house at which he has often been a guest. A wonderful, auspicious beginning to their marriage, Danny believed those weeks would be. But after the first week of their time at the house had passed...
there was suddenly the phone call from Ralph asking if it would be all right for Maria to come up and stay with them. Maria was about to be released after 14 days in jail.
Oh, Danny had known about Maria's sentencing. He and Phoebe had talked about it earlier on.
So severe for an anti-nuclear protest and for a woman of Maria's age.
Oh, but they had not entirely been clear as to when Maria started to serve, nor when she was to get out. And it had certainly not occurred to Danny that Maria might want to come from jail.
To her house on the Truckee River.
However, of course, he told Ralph. Hanging up the phone, which is in the kitchen, and walking across the long living room toward their bedroom, where he and Phoebe had been taking a semi-nap, Danny considered how he would put it to Phoebe, this quite unforeseen interruption to their time. Well, Danny knows that he is crazy about Phoebe, but also acknowledges to himself some slight fear. He suspects that she is perceptibly stronger than he is. Also, it was he who insisted on marriage and finally talked her into it, mentioning their ages, or not exactly kids, plus the bribe of the house. But the real truth was that Danny feared losing her. He had indecisively lost a couple of other really nice women. Now he wanted to settle down. In any case, Although he feels himself loved by Phoebe, feels glad of their marriage, he worries perhaps unduly about her reactions. You see, it was such a great favor that I couldn't not do it, was one of the things he decided to say to Phoebe, approaching their room. All that time in jail, a much longer sentence than anyone had thought she would get, I think her old protest history worked against her. I know it was supposed to be our house for these 2 weeks. Ralph kept saying that. He really felt bad asking me to do this, Danny meant to add. What he did not mean to say to Phoebe, in part because he did not know quite how to phrase it, was his own sense that if Maria were to come up to them, Ralph should come too.
Ralph's presence would make a better balance.
Also,
Ralph's frenetic, nervous energy, his offbeat wit.
Both qualities that made Danny smile, just to think about.
Would have lightened the atmosphere.
Which so far had been more than a little heavy, what with the weather and Maria's silences, her clearly sagging spirits. However, Dan barely mentioned to Phoebe that Maria was getting out of jail on July 19th.
When Phoebe broke in, oh, then she must come right up. Do you think we should leave or stay on and sort of take care of her? I could cook a lot. Prison food has to be horrible. Tell Ralph not to worry. It'll be fine.
All of which led Danny to think that he does not know Phoebe well at all.
Phoebe herself has had certain odd new problems on this trip. Trouble eating, for one thing. She, who generally eats more than her envious friends can believe, scrawny Phoebe of the miraculous metabolism, now barely manages a scant first helping of the good cold rice salads, the various special dishes she planned and made for this first leisurely time alone with Dan. And she is sometimes short of breath. Also, despite long, happy nights of love, she has trouble sleeping. All these problems clearly have to do with the altitude, 6,000 feet. Phoebe knows that perfectly well. Still, does it possibly have something to do with being married? Married in haste, as the old phrase used to go? By far her worst problem, though, is sheer discomfort from the heat. So much heavy sun all day. Like many redheads, Phoebe does not do well in very warm weather, the affliction being an inability to perspire. Instead, out in the sun, her skin seems to wither and burn, both within and without. Very likely, she thinks, if it cooled off even a little, all her troubles would disappear. She could eat and sleep again and enjoy being married to Dan. However, she reminds herself, there would still be the house.
Danny talked about it often. He tried to describe Maria's house.
And Phoebe gathered that it was beautiful.
Impressive, even.
Still, she was unprepared for what seems to her
somewhat stark.
Such bare structural bones.
Exposed textures of pine and fir.
Such very high vaulted ceilings.
Phoebe has never been in a house
with so definite a tone.
A stamp.
In fact, both the house's unfamiliarity and the strength of its character have been more than a little intimidating. Phoebe is from a small town in New Hampshire of entirely conventional, rather small-scale architecture. Even the bookcases have yielded up to Phoebe few clues of a personal nature, containing, as they do, a large, clearly much-used collection
of various field guides to birds, wildflowers, trees, and rocks.
Some yellow thumb through grade B detective fiction.
And a large, highly eclectic shelf of poetry.
Rilke, Auden, Yeats.
Plus a great many small volumes of women poets. Marianne Moore, Elizabeth Bishop, Louise Bogan, Katha Pollitt, Amy Clampett.
Clues, but to Ralph or to Maria?
Ralph's father, Maria's husband, died young, Dan has said. He has spoken admiringly of Maria's uncompromising professionalism, her courage. Never a shopping center or a sleazy tract.
The poetry, then, might belong to them both? There are no inscriptions. Thus, occupying the house of two very strong, individualistic people,
neither of whom
she has met,
fills Phoebe with some unease, even a sort of loneliness. The sight of the house, though, is so very beautiful, magical even.
That very private stretch of clear brown river rushing over its smoothly rounded, wonderfully tinted rocks.
And the surrounding woods of pine and fir and shimmering gray-green aspens and the lovely sky and clouds.
The very air smells of summer and earth and trees. In such a place, Phoebe thinks, how can she not feel perfectly well, not be absolutely happy? Indeed, she has admitted this to herself, though not to Dan. She welcomed Maria, at least in part, as a diversion.
Though, since her arrival,
Maria has seemed neither especially diverting, as Phoebe had hoped,
nor heroic,
as they both had believed.
It would have been a lot better if Ralph were here too, I know that, Danny tells Phoebe later that morning as barefoot they pick their way back across the meadow to the house. They had been swimming in the river.
Or rather, wading and ducking down into the water.
Which is disappointingly shallow, slow-moving, not the icy rush that Danny remembers from previous visits.
Phoebe, though, seems to feel considerably better. She walks along sure-footedly, a little ahead of Dan, and her tone is reassuring as she says, it's all right. I think Maria's just really tired. I'm doing a vitello tonnato for lunch, though. Remember? From the restaurant? Maybe she'll like that. God, I just wish I could eat.
Avoiding sharp pine cones and sticks and skirting jagged rocks requires attention.
And so they are quiet for a while as they walk along.
But then, although he is in fact looking where he is going, Dan's foot hits something terrible and sharp and he cries out, ah, damn!
What's wrong?
My foot. I think a stone.
Oh, dear. Phoebe has stopped and turned to ask, shall I look?
No, it's okay. Nothing, Dan mutters, striding on past her. But he is thinking, well, really, how like Ralph to saddle me with his mother on my honeymoon? And with Maria just out of jail, for God's sakes. So politically correct that I couldn't possibly object. Damn Ralph, anyway.
Never having met Ralph, who has been in Los Angeles for all the time that Dan and Phoebe have known each other.
The long, not long 4 months.
Phoebe has no clear view of him, although Dan talks about him often. What has mostly come across to Phoebe
is the strength of the two men's affection for each other.
So rare in her experience.
Such open fondness between men.
She has even briefly wondered if they could have been lovers ever.
And concluded
that they were not. They are simply close, as she and her friend partner Anna are close.
Danny would do almost anything for Ralph.
Including taking in his mother.
At a not entirely convenient time.
In fact, his strong, evident affections are among the qualities Phoebe values in Dan. And perhaps Ralph is more or less like that. His closeness to his mother has had that effect. Although so far Maria herself has not come across as an especially warm or giving person.
Early common ground discovered by Dan and Phoebe on their first meeting.
Was a firm belief in political protest.
They had both taken part in demonstrations against the Nicaraguan embargo.
Against South African racism.
Both felt that there was generally a mood of protest in their city, San Francisco, that spring.
By which they were encouraged. And they had had serious talks about going to jail.
Taking part in demonstrations is not the same as being locked up.
They are.
Agreed.
It's hard to figure out just how much good it does. Jail.
Especially if you're not famous, just a person. Ellsberg going to jail is something else.
Do famous people get lighter sentences?
I'd imagine. In fact, I'd bet.
So hard to figure. Is it better to go to jail or to stay out and do whatever your work is and send money to your cause.
Impossible to decide.
Had been their conclusion.
However, someone probably has to go to jail. They think that too. So why not them?
Working in the kitchen, making lunch, Phoebe feels better than she has for several days. Good effects of the dip into the river seem to last. A lively sense of water lingers on her skin. Carefully, thinly slicing the firm, moist white turkey, she is good at this, a good carver, Phoebe feels more in control of her life than she has in days just past. No longer entirely at the mercy of weather and altitude. She even feels more at peace with the house. Here in the kitchen, its bareness and extreme simplicity seem functional. The oversized butcher block table with its long rack for knives is a great working space. She is happily breaking an egg into the blender, reaching for oil, when she hears
the sound of slow footsteps approaching the kitchen.
It must be Maria. And the distress that Phoebe then experiences is both general and particular. She likes best to cook alone. In fact, she loves the solitary single-mindedness of cooking. Also, none of her conversations with Maria have been very successful so far.
Hesitantly, distractedly, Maria comes to stand outside the kitchen door. Vaguely, she asks, I'm sure I can't help you. She is not quite looking at Phoebe, but rather out the window to the river. But I did wonder, you're finding everything you need.
Oh, yes, it's a wonderful kitchen. Working there, it has become clear to Phoebe that Maria herself must be a very good cook. This is the working space of a dedicated person. I feel bad displacing you this way, she says to Maria. This earns
the most direct
and also
the most humorous look
from Maria yet seen.
You're good to say that. But actually, I could use a little displacement, probably.
Phoebe ventures, do you have trouble letting people help you the way I do?
A wide, if fleeting grin. Oh, indeed I do. I seem to believe myself quite indispensable in certain areas. They smile.
Acknowledging some kinship.
Well, I won't keep you. Maria begins to leave. Then, from whatever inner depths of thought, she remarks, I do wish Ralph were here, too. It would be nice for you to meet him here.
It would have been, agrees Phoebe. But sometime.
Lunch, though,
is no better than breakfast.
Conversationally.
And in Phoebe's judgment, even the food is not entirely successful.
They are gathered again on the terrace above the river.
Joined at the two large round table.
Scattered around it.
However, partly because he knows
that Phoebe is genuinely curious,
as he is himself, Danny persists in asking about Maria's time in jail. Also, he is convinced that talking about it will help Maria. What does Pleasanton look like? He asks her. I can't even imagine it.
Oh, at Maria's first vague, unfocused glance goes out to the river as though for help. But then she seems to make an effort for her guests. It's quite country club looking, she tells them. Very clean and bland.
In a tantalizing way, she adds,
it's rather like the White House.
Really? How?
How?
This had been a chorus from Dan and Phoebe. Maria sighs and continues to try. Well, externally, it's so clean. And behind the scene, there's total corruption. Having gone so far, though, she leans back into her chair and closes her eyes.
Dan looks at Phoebe. On her face, he sees
both blighted curiosity and genuine, if momentary, helplessness.
He sees, too, her discomfort from the increasing heat.
Her skin is so bright, dry, pink.
The sultry air has curled her hair so tightly that it looks uncomfortable. At that moment, Danny believes that he feels all Phoebe's unvoiced, unspoken sensations.
Her feelings are his.
And he further thinks, I am married to Phoebe permanently for good. And looking at his wife and at Maria, whom he has always known, Danny thinks how incredibly complex women are, how interesting they are.
In Maine, the air never felt exactly like this air, Maria tells them, as though Maine had been under discussion again. A little like it, fresh and clean, but not exactly. It's interesting. The difference, I mean. Though hard to describe, she trails off.
I know what you mean, though, comments Phoebe. In the same way that all the colors are different, but you can't exactly say how.
Phoebe grew up in New Hampshire, Danny tells Maria, wondering why this fact had not emerged earlier, or did it?
Oh, did you really? But Maria has returned to her own privacy, her thoughts.
The heat has gathered and intensified. Phoebe feels that she will burst, her skin rent apart, the way a tomato skin will split in heat. What she also feels is a kind of rage, though she tries to tell herself that she is simply hot, that she feels so ill-tempered only because of the weather, the temperature. And knowing herself, certain bad tendencies, she determines that she will not say how angry she is, and especially she will not take it out on Danny. I love Dan. The weather is not his fault, nor really is absent Ralph. Gross, inconsiderate, totally selfish Ralph. Some friend, thinks Phoebe. She and Dan are lying across their bed, ostensibly napping, although the turgid air seems entirely to forbid real sleep.
Naked.
They still do not touch.
Although earlier Dan has asked, can I douse you with some cold water or maybe an alcohol rub?
No, thanks. But really, thanks. It was at that moment that Phoebe determined not to vent her ire on Dan, who was genuinely kind, well-meaning.
They have both been whispering.
Although no one could conceivably hear them.
The rooms being so spread apart, Maria's is several rooms away.
Maria simply clutches that prison experience to herself, doesn't she? Now whispers Phoebe. Not that she much wants to talk about anything else either.
Except Maine. Danny tries a small laugh. Well, lots of Maine.
And the way she eats, complains Phoebe bitterly. Just bolting down a few bites and then a dead stop. It's not exactly flattering. Not that I really care. I mean, did she always eat like that?
I can't remember. Maybe not. I didn't notice, really.
I have to say, though, announces Phoebe, I really think this is a very selfish move on Ralph's part.
Dan very lightly sighs, just shifting in bed. I'm afraid I agree. But people change, I think. Maybe he's pure LA these days, more selfish than he used to be. He's been seeing some shrink down there for years.
That whole culture's so selfish, crass.
Right.
Feeling a little better, Phoebe reaches her fingers just to graze.
They look at each other. They smile.
Dinner that night,
which, again, is out on the terrace,
is in many ways a repeat of lunch.
Except, of course, for the menu. Provident Phoebe has made a nice cold pasta.
With garlicky brandied prawns.
But Maria again eats very little, and that most rapidly. And again, she talks about Maine. The soil was so rocky around our house, it was hard to grow flowers, she says. I've never even tried to plant anything out there.
The night is densely dark.
Pitch black. In an absolute and final way, it is still.
And heavy. The air seems weighted.
Oppressive.
Stultifying.
I do wish Ralph could have been here. It is Dan who has said this, not having at all intended to. It simply slipped out like a sigh, and now he feels tactless. But it's great that he has so much work down there, he feebly amends.
I suppose so. Unhelpful Marie puts her fork down and stares out into the black.
Going about the house, as every night he has, checking doors, turning off lights, for the first time on his visit, Danny has a sad sense of spuriousness. This is not his house. He is much more guest than host. And he recalls now that this place has always been somewhat daunting. Its proportions make him feel even less tall than, in fact, he is. And very possibly, Phoebe's deepest reactions have been similar. She, too, has been made uncomfortable by the house, in addition to the appalling heat, her enemy. Well, none of these facts augur poorly for their marriage, though, Danny believes. Once they are back in San Francisco, in the cool, foggy summer weather, in their own newly painted rooms, they will be fine. He admits to himself, however, some real disappointment over what he feels as the failure of connection between Maria and Phoebe. When Ralph called about Maria's coming up just out of jail, along with disappointment at the curtailment of their privacy, Danny experienced a small surge of happy expectation. Maria and Phoebe, despite obvious differences of age, career, could become great friends, a compliment to his own friendship with Ralph. And now that this rapport seems entirely unlikely, Danny recognizes the strength of his hope, his conviction even, that it might have taken place. Before starting his tour of the house, Dan urged Phoebe to go and take a long, cool bath. Do you a world of good, he told her. And that presumably is where Phoebe is now, in the bathroom down the hall.
The distance between bathrooms and bedrooms in this house seems an almost deliberate inconvenience.
As Dan gets into bed, he hears nothing. No sound from anywhere. Outside the window, the air is motionless, still. The river is soundless, slow. And although he knows that in a few minutes Phoebe will be there with him, Danny experiences a solitude that seems entire and final. And then,
around midnight,
everything breaks.
Brilliant flashes of lightning split open the sky.
Thunder roars.
A sound of huge rocks falling down a mountainside.
Blitz of light.
Crashing noise. Entirely awake and a little scared, Phoebe abruptly remembers Maria this morning as she talked about thunderstorms in Maine.
Actually, I'd be quite terrified. I always used to be, is what Maria said.
To Dan,
who was much less fully awake, he seemed to have trouble going to sleep at all.
Phoebe whispers, I'm just going down to see if Maria's all right. Slipping into her sandals, pulling on her light cotton robe and the new blessed cool, Phoebe begins to feel her way down the narrow, pine-smelling hall to Maria's room at the end, the room nearest the river. Seeing no light beneath the door, she hesitates. But then, very gently, she knocks, at the same time saying firmly and loudly enough to be heard across the thunder crashes, It's Phoebe! For a moment, there is no response at all. Then,
some faint sound comes from Maria.
That Phoebe chooses to interpret as assent. Entering, she sees Maria upright in bed, sitting erect but pressed back, braced against the headboard.
Oh!
Is all she says to Phoebe. Coming over to stand beside her, Phoebe asks, Should I turn the light on? And she reaches toward the bedside lamp on its table.
Maria stops her crying. Electricity, don't!
Recognizing true panic,
Phoebe quietly tells her, I'll just stay here for a minute, if you don't mind. In the strange half-light between crashes,
Maria reaches for her hand. She says, thank you.
And can just be seen to smile
before quickly releasing Phoebe.
Outside, a heavy pounding rain has now begun, but the thunderstorm seems suddenly to be over. There is only the hard drumbeat of rain on the shingled roof, the thud of water on window panes. Phoebe pulls the small bent wood chair from Maria's desk over to the bed and sits down.
Maria says, it was good of you to remember.
I was a little scared, admits Phoebe.
The thing about prison, Maria takes this up as though prison had just then been under discussion, is that they do everything to wreck your mind. Mind f***, some of the younger women call it. A faint, tight smile. But they do. Rushing you all the time. Starting you in to do something, and then right away it's over. Even eating, even that horrible food I never got to finish. They mix up everybody's mail, so you think it must be on purpose. And the noise, radios, people smoking.
Jesus, is all Phoebe can manage to say.
Maria is leaning forward now.
Her eyes, luminous, deep, immense.
At my age, she says. I mean, I often wonder where my mind is going anyway without all that.
That's frightful. Terrible.
Well, it was terrible. I didn't want to admit it to myself. I got just so plain scared. The truth is, I'm still scared.
Well, of course. Anyone is scared of jail. I'm not even sure I could do it.
Maria's gaze in the semi-dark seems to take all of Phoebe in. I think you would if you had to. Or thought you had to, she says.
I hope so.
But I'm worried about going back there, Maria tells her. If, for some reason, I had to. Again.
At that moment, however, a new sound has begun.
Just audible through the steady, heavy rain.
And lights can be seen to approach the house very slowly.
Lights from a car.
Visible to them both.
Unnecessarily, Phoebe announces, someone's coming. A small sports car. Whoever...
It must be Ralph, says Maria, smiling. And she exclaims, oh, but I do think things will be better now. It's even gotten cool. Did you feel it? But in an anxious way, her face still searches Phoebe's. Do you want to turn on the light?
Phoebe reaches to touch Maria's hand, very quickly, lightly, before she pushes the switch. Standing up, then, in the sudden brightness, smiling, as Phoebe moves toward the door, she turns back to Maria. She tells her, I'll get Danny. We'll go make sandwiches. Some tea? Poor Ralph, all that driving. We'll celebrate.
Favors by Alice Adams. It was performed by James Wagner as Danny, Josiah Balhemus as Ralph, Rosie Hallett as Phoebe, and Patricia Silver as Maria. The director was Amy Casso. We thank Alice's son, Peter Lindenthal, for his permission to perform the story. And of course, thanks to Word for Word co-artistic directors Susan Harlow and Joanne Winter for their continued stewardship of Word for Word and for their continued collaboration with us here on Open Air as part of our Corona Radio Theater Initiative. Learn more at our link at our website about continuing things happening with Word for Word. And now an abbreviated segment with Peter Robinson. Apologies, Peter, for the brief segment, but we have to leave our actors to give us some space for their art. Thanks for your understanding.
Okay, David, am I on or am I off? I can't tell.
You've been on through quite a bit of today, including during the show. So please, let's hear a little bit about November, shall we?
Okay. Well, my quick thought about November is that this is a month of everything. It starts with the Day of the Dead. It moves on to the music which takes us out. And that indeed is the end of what we hear and what we know about November. It's Louis Armstrong playing Autumn Leaves. They fall by my window. And yes, I think about Thanksgiving. I think about Veterans Day. And of course, I think about Keats, the season of mist and mellow fruitfulness. So there we have it. But above all, what we did have was Word for Word, one of the great recitation theatres where you actually hear the words, listen to the voice, and put the pictures in your head. That's radio at its very best. Something you can hear in your head, even in the misty month of November. And a special thanks to Louis Armstrong, taking us out with that magnificent song, Autumn Leaves, as they pass by your window.
And that's Open Air for this week. Our shows are archived at KALW.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show, Damian D. Minor in the studios of KALW, and to you, dear audience, for enduring some of our technical difficulties as we navigate this brave new world of Zoom live theater, live radio, muted mics, unmuted mics, and the like. Your indulgent on local public radio, KALW San Francisco, is appreciated. And a reminder that if you're a fan of theater on radio, tune in tomorrow night for LA Theater Works. You'll enjoy the performance there. It's from 8 to 10. And this week, a South London parish priest undergoes a crisis of faith with potentially devastating consequences, examining issues both timeless and contemporary. It's David Hare's Racing Demon. Tomorrow night from 8 to 10 here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe. Join me again next week. Jake Heggie among my special guests for Open Air.